ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Don't have enough time to stay across all the latest news? ABC News Top Stories podcast explains the biggest breaking news stories and why they matter in less than 2 minutes. So you can hit play and get updated while brushing your teeth or making your lunch. It's always up to date, ready whenever you're ready to get across the day's news. Just search ABC News Top Stories podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts and hit follow or favourite to add us to your playlist.
Jez, one of my favourite words, we like to talk about words a bit on here, is like mind-boggling. Like, I love the idea of a mind being boggled. And this week when I thought about the Iranian women's football team threatened with execution possibly back home, we don't know if we want to, if they want to stay. There's talk about like them putting up a sign asking for help as they're driving off in their bus, and then this story of like running away from the security down the stairs in the hotel in the middle of the night. Like, it's pretty wild.
And all this has really just taken off in the last couple of weeks when they appeared in their very first match of the Asian Football Cup, and the women's soccer team, the Iranian women's soccer team, didn't sing the national anthem, didn't salute. And that was picked up at home back in Iran, where they were labelled traitors. And this is where the concern for their safety has really dramatically...
Traitors that need to be dealt with severely. And now, next minute, here they are running down these stairs, bundled into cars. We have photos of them with Tony Burke, Jez. It's astonishing.
I'm Jeremy Fernandez in Sydney on Gadigal land.
And I'm Julia Baird, and this is Not Stupid. And what do we do on Not Stupid, Jess?
We discuss the news in your feeds. God, there's been a lot of it at the moment. Plus the stuff that's grabbing our attention, Jules.
Yeah, and which is the Iranian women's football team. Jez, let's talk about where we are now. Now, we're recording this on Tuesday afternoon.
There's lots going on in Iran, and I just want to nod to the fact that there are multiple developments in this story all at the same time. Iran has a new official supreme leader.
Yes.
The son of the Ayatollah, who is described as even more hardline than his father. He's been the brains trust in his father's governance of Iran.
And we're seen as being a successor anyway to an 86-year-old man.
Plus, Australia announcing it's sending troops to the UAE to help defence against the Iranian bombs that have been raining on
all around the region. Yep. Enormous amount of destruction.
And talks of American and Israeli boots on the ground going into Iran. So lots developing there. We're going to focus today, Jules, on this extraordinary development in Australia. What happens with the women's soccer team?
Because what it does is bring the stories to our soil and we understand it or think about it in a much more immediate kind of way.
And it calls on us to kind of really have a hard think about what we do as a country, where our values individually and collectively as a nation stand.
That's right. And who requires protection. Okay, so as of now, we have five of these football players who are being offered protection by Australia and have been given humanitarian visas. Look, they were very worried about, like, if they stayed in Australia, I understand that there would be severe consequences for their families back home.
And it was unclear the extent to which the team or individuals in the team wanted to stay in Australia, right? Because they've been under heavy guard since they arrived. And so there's been kind of this reading of body language from outside the bus by reporters, by observers about what signals they were sending and their decision not to sing the national anthem, and then also said to be making that universal hand sign.
Whole hand stretched out, thumb into the palm, fold the four fingers over the top.
And what does that mean?
That means help. I'm in trouble.
And this is used in domestic violence contexts as
That's right.
It's a thing that people are taught to know.
To signal. If it would be unsafe for you to indicate publicly, like, get me out of here, or this man is threatening me, or like, you can actually signal it subtly,
and at least one of the lionesses was seen to have done this inside the bus.
Inside the bus. So, Jez, what I understand is that there was a message smuggled out of Iran from a player's family through a contact in Turkey. That's what the Australian is reporting. That was the final tipping point. And there were four words: you need to stay. Then, within hours of getting that message, we have the women bundled into this bundled into a car out of the Royal Pines Hotel with, says the Oz here, three team officials in hot pursuit down the hotel stairs, only to find the public access door to the hotel garage locked. Imagine the beating of your heart when you are attempting that escape, when you're attempting to get away from that kind of surveillance.
It's right up there with the most suspenseful movie scenes, except this is real life, and it is life and death. It is life and death.
Yeah.
For not only these players, but for their families back home. What a position to be in to have to make this decision.
Exactly. Okay, well, let's talk about why. So now we have five women. They're under federal police protection. They're at a safe house in Brisbane. And we know that they'd been having secret meetings with the government for a couple of days. So we really need to keep our eyes, obviously, on what's going to happen from here. Now, Tony Burke, Home Affairs Minister, said that fleeing was a difficult decision. He's assuring the other members if they want to stay, they can. And this women's soccer team called the Lionesses. I kind of want to talk briefly, Jez, before we get to why them not singing the national anthem was such a big deal with potentially like fatal consequences. Like when I was watching them play the Matildas on the weekend, I was just looking at them with such admiration to be there and playing the game at all in a country where women have few rights, where for a long time, until only just recently, women weren't supposed to be watching football from stadiums.
Let alone playing it.
Let alone playing it.
It is so far outside what is expected of them that it's quite extraordinary. But FIFA does have this rule, doesn't it, that in order to field a men's team,
yes,
the country has to field a women's team.
Yes. So there was in the 1970s, there was a women's football team, and this was in Iran, and that was abandoned after the 1979 revolution. It took until 2004 for it to be refounded. Straight out of the gates was doing really well, but they were banned from international competition briefly in 2011 for wearing hijabs. Women who were playing also, by the way, and saw that if their hijabs kind of came off, were also penalised by Iran. So after that, Iran forfeited its bid to qualify for the Summer Olympics that year. And anyway, they lifted the ban. There's been ongoing reluctance or unwillingness, according to the BBC, for the Iranian Football Federation to have a women's team at all. After the protests at the end of last year, a number of players resigned from the football team and the refereeing organisation because of the massacres. And then the local football federation was then threatening them with bans, judicial action, long prison sentences. It is highly fraught to be playing that game in Iran, and I think they are fully deserving of our respect. And just a quick point about the sports stadiums. So there was a football fan called Saha Kodiyari. She was actually called the Blue Girl, and she loved this team, dressed as a man to go and watch them at this male-only stadium, and then was busted for this. She was going to face a six-month prison sentence, and outside the courtroom she set herself on fire and died from her injuries a week later. So after Iran was chosen for the 2022 World Cup, FIFA said women have to be allowed into the stadium to watch international matches. This is like only a couple of years ago, Jez. It's only 4 years ago. So after she died, Saha, women were admitted for the first time after 40 years. So, but it's still like in 2022, some women were still blocked from watching a match.
2022 as well. I just want to point out here, in terms of this surge of unrest in Iran, Mahsa Amini, her death, this is a woman who was arrested, mysteriously died in custody.
Yes.
And this triggered a whole movement and uprising in Iran and around the world. We saw protests here in Australia as well.
Yes.
About the treatment of women. So the expectations of women and how they're expected to dress to behave is directly tied to what this football team is doing.
Yes.
And the position it puts Australia in now about what to do in offering them asylum and how it reverberates out to the rest of the team, to those officials who failed to keep them isolated from Australian society and from the fans and from officials here.
So then we have them not singing the national anthem in the match against South Korea. Like, with everything that had been going on, all the heat, I mean, their country is currently in the middle of a war.
And that was, I think, 2 days after the Ayatollah was killed, right? So, I mean, lots of emotions going on, no doubt, just as Iranian citizens.
But the guts of not singing the national anthem.
So publicly.
Then after that, after there was outcry like that was so intense, they did then go and sing and salute the anthem at the next two matches, including against the Matildas. But, Jez, if you look at some of the reaction, it was pretty intense. As we've spoken about, they've been accused of, there's a state television presenter who accused them of dishonour. They called them wartime traitors who must be dealt with more severely. Now, we know that under the relevant laws of the country, they could be facing execution. So this then, although, of course, provoked a whole bunch of other people to be arguing that they should be protected.
Yeah, a lot of pressure on the Australian government. And I was really, I want to get your take on this, Jules, because I saw an interview that Carl Stefanovic did on his new podcast with Pauline Hanson and Barnaby Joyce.
Yep.
And here's how they've phrased it, right? So Pauline Hanson said, I'm very cautious of it, this idea of offering asylum. I'm not going to open up the floodgates. You've got millions of people wanting the same treatment. Barnaby Joyce agreed. He said, your heart might say, yeah, yeah, do it. But you've got to engage your head. There's a whole heap of people in exactly the same position, and we can't bring over hundreds of thousands of people. And he put that down to a consideration of Australia's capacity. When you open the floodgates, as he put it, and lower the standard to which people should be accepted into Australia on the basis of their distress or
Is that standard been lowered if you're facing imminent death?
Okay, so what in order to be consistent, how do we think about this? Because I wonder if there's a seed of truth there that calls us to reconsider what it means to offer asylum to someone and where that standard lies. Because they're right. Mm. There are lots of people who, for the same reasons, would be seeking asylum in countries like Australia.
Mm. Well, that's why humanitarian visas are so important. And that's why we need to respect the people who come and seek asylum on humanitarian grounds and not vilify them and cast them as something else or see them as nameless, faceless people, because suddenly when you see a face and you hear a story and you realise you might be spinning on your heels and facing the death of yourself or your family, or maybe you get a different response. Maybe it is – I mean, what were, for example, the politicians you cite, what was their position on the war? So do we go and – assist the war efforts, but then not accept that there are this for the same reasons we might be providing some assistance to America, we should also be recognizing that there will be people seeking refuge here.
What was interesting to me about those comments is that there is that same language of floodgates, that people are flooding Australia from elsewhere. We've seen the same language in the March for Australia rallies around the country, that Australia is being overwhelmed by migrants, when we actually know, relatively speaking, Australia's somewhat generous, but most people who are displaced around the world, so tens of millions of them, are actually in the countries surrounding these regions, surrounding countries like Iran.
My view is, yes, there is immense amount of human need, and there will be a lot of people who will want to come here. If their concern is about being overwhelmed, let's talk about the gates. Like, do we all agree on the number of humanitarian refugees? Should there be more? Should there be more discretion allowed in times of war? Should there be more discussion, as Martin Parkinson said, who did the review into immigration for Labor, saying that we need to be more adept and more targeted and clever about, you know, skilled visas, for example, skilled worker visas. So I think my point being that can we talk about whether the system is doing what it needs
it
to be doing?
Yeah.
You know, instead of preying on any anxiety that might exist in Australia, that there's a flood. We're talking about a group of five women here, by the way.
There is also a question, Jules, about the moral, ethical and legal obligations that Australia has now that we have custodianship of these women, as long as they're playing in Australia, whether we send them back. The New South Wales Anti-Slavery Commissioner, Dr. James Cocaine, was saying that these women were not allowed out of their hotel without chaperones. They were denied freedom of speech, freedom of movement in Australia, and that constitutes a breach on some levels of their freedom in Australia. And so for them to be forced back to their country of origin could constitute a legal, ethical, moral breach.
I'd like to talk about the involvement of the American president in this. I want to run past a headline in the Washington Post. Australia grants asylum to five Iranian women's soccer players after Trump pressure.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Actually, that is also the headline in the AFR. Burke grants asylum to Iranian players after Trump Albanese call. Look, let's talk about the fact that Trump has kind of come out of the blue and suddenly, now not a man who's shown any great enthusiasm for female sports.
Or migrants.
Or migrants, yep, getting to that, has suddenly gone, Australia has to do the right thing here and they have to give asylum. They're posting on Truth Social, just one word, asylum, and really saying, you know, Albanese needs to be on top of this. But then another one saying, oh, he is on it. The implication, I would have thought, would be that conversations had been undergoing before.
Well, exactly, Jules, because, I mean, this is one of the things, you work in news, right? And, I mean, for the most part, we publish what we know. We don't withhold things from the public. But there was also this sense I was getting, you know, over this past week and a half that things were going on in the background that we weren't aware of as the media, as the general public. But the fact that the government was staying so quiet and measured about
Penny this. Wong was saying, we stand with the Iranian women's football team. I couldn't possibly comment on anything else. So we didn't know. We didn't know if they wanted to stay. We didn't know if there were talks, but clearly there were.
So that is what gives me pause for suspicion when Donald Trump claims this to have been his idea, that apparently no one else in Australia was considering this prior.
Okay, Jez, let's just spare a moment for the Iranians living in America who have in recent months been deported back to Iran, irrespective of any persecution they might be facing there. Now, the Trump administration flipped a decades-old policy of allowing Iranians to stay under those circumstances. And the first flight left in late September. They'd cut a deal with the regime in Tehran. Now Trump is at war with that regime. But the administration has reportedly sent about three plane loads of Iranians back to Iran, including Christian converts, ethnic minorities, and political dissidents. According to a Senate report written by Democrats last month, at least eight people from the first flight begged to not be sent back because they were scared for their lives. There was at least one flight that occurred in January. That was after the protest, during which Trump had said help was on its way. And according to the American Immigration Council, the administration nearly deported two gay men back to Iran, where they would have likely faced the death penalty. But at the last minute, they were saved by legal intervention. So one might think if you were one of those people, Jez, you might wonder what's actually going on here.
Jules, also interesting to note that June, July, the US is going to be hosting the FIFA World Cup, where Iran is expected to field a men's soccer team. What happens then if they do seek asylum? I wonder what the Trump administration's response to that would be.
Now, Jez, you know I'm not a betting woman, but I would put a fairly substantial amount of money on you not having watched Married at First Sight.
Look, I've tuned in every once in a while, but I'm going to plead work commitments because I'm normally on air when MAFS is going to air. But I do work with people.
So it's only on Sunday. There's only a slight overlap on Sunday
remain
night.
Unnamed.
Me.
Who are deeply enthused and will tell me to my face, oh yeah, I didn't see you on the news because I was watching MAFS.
Okay, that wasn't me.
Rude. It wasn't you. Actually, it has been you once.
What?
It has been.
Yeah. What? Did I tell you that?
Yeah.
Oops. Maybe it was a good plot.
But it is an interesting show, though. I mean, you can't discount something that, you know, like we were talking about with Jackie O and Kyle Santalance last week.
Yeah.
There is something to be said for something that is so gripping for such a huge number of people. And I think as a study of what we find interesting and what we look for in entertainment.
Yeah. Do you know what I reckon
I think it's actually
is?
Really interesting.
Because I've got such a strange mixture of people who, like, this is the first year I've properly watched it.
So you watching like a full episode and then
Full episode after I switch across from ABC News with Jeremy Fernandez. I will watch it. Well, there's two that you have to, that you watch, a dinner party night where they all get together and usually scream at each other. And then the commitment ceremony was when they say if they're going to stay for another week. I reckon what it is it allows you to kind of like say, no, mate, you can't act like that towards this person. No, you can't. It's like you somehow get really quickly involved in thinking, oh, that's in judging in a way, really. Oh, that person's really decent. Don't be so hard on them. Give them another chance. And then on Sunday night, you get to see like the relationship experts sit there and say, well, that was disgusting the way you were that person. I think there's something weirdly cathartic about sitting down. Now, the one person who's got a lot of attention, Jez, is Tyson.
I have no idea who Tyson is, yeah. So enlighten me.
30-year-old property investor from Queensland. He's also a Christian guy, and he was paired up with a 32-year-old real estate agent who's also very successful. Massive salary last year, apparently.
And 700 odd K. Like on paper, what? How does this work? Do they, on paper, they look like they'd be a good match?
They do claim to match people who would be, might not appear it from the outside, but would actually make a good pairing. Now, these two are very conservative, both like Donald Trump. Both from Queensland, both driven, both attractive, like you could think.
This sounds like a good match.
But Tyson is what he would call traditional, and what he's been looking for overtly is a submissive wife.
Is it? I feel like tradition is being applied in a very broad sense here.
Exactly. So a lot of people have been trying to get him to spell out what exactly that means. Now, it's clear that he thinks that the man is the leader, the man is dominant, the man works, the woman stays home, all that kind of stuff. And I have to say, the woman paired opposite him is not a feminist, but she's constantly been kind of finding him sexist and arrogant, the things he's saying, and so pushing back on the submissive wife thing, saying you don't want me to have an opinion or a view. Or Laura Byrne, who's hosted a satellite show, there's a show after a show, Jez, which I actually haven't seen, called After the Dinner Party, and they interview the MAFS people as they go along. So they're already finished their experiment. We're watching it aired. Then they have a show afterwards where they have the characters.
This is like a debrief slash therapy.
So she says, look, I've looked up the dictionary. Submissive means compliant and obedient. Is that what you want? And Tyson says, I think I would like to be the leader of the house. Laura, do you want someone who is obedient? Tyson, would you say that is controlling, being the leader of the house? Laura, if you want someone who is obedient, yes, it is controlling, and you want a dog. Tyson says, maybe that is what I want.
I'm getting like fifth-hand embarrassment here, by the way.
That's the weird thing, is saying this out loud. Like,
yeah.
But then he goes, look, I don't want a literal dog. I want to be the man of the house. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't mean literally put a leash on. Okay, reassuring. I don't want my wife to feel like a dog or slave, but I do like these traditional values.
Do you get a sense of what it is like? I wonder, like, in my most generous interpretation of this.
Yes.
Has he got a poor vocabulary to articulate what it is he actually wants? And do you get a sense of what it is he actually designs?
Okay, here. I appreciate that generous reading. I agree with a poor
vocab. A dog but not a dog doesn't make sense to me. So I'm trying to kind of read between the lines of what he's trying to say.
I think in a way it's complete bluntness though.
Right.
You know, and I think if he could be a bit more disingenuous. Like if he had more words to play with, he could say, oh, no, I just mean traditional. We're equal but very different in our roles. Do you know what I mean? And her work is very important doing blah, blah, blah. But actually he's like, no, well, it's not like I want, you know, you don't have to be, it's not actually a dog, but I do want someone who will follow my leadership, who will submit.
How much do you trace this? You mentioned before that he's Christian.
Mm.
How much do you trace this to a faith-based interpretation of gender roles?
Mm.
And how do they each square that with their appreciation of the values that Donald Trump espouses?
Yeah, I do think it's what you and I have spoken out a bit, where the manosphere meets the hard right in terms of attitudes towards women. We know there are two things that are going on, which is firstly the conservative attitudes towards women are gaining much more credence amongst younger people. So Gen Z, there was a study out this week, Gen Z men twice as likely as boomers to think a woman should obey her husband. So that is going on. But then we also have, a Christianity. Look, I mean, I think a lot of people would say, okay, if Christianity is meant to be about love, joy, peace, faith, patience, gentleness, goodness, kindness, self-control, humility, we're not seeing a lot of that in this approach. It really
comes across very strongly as about controlling someone. And I do think it exposes that element of manosphere and hard right way of talking about women and wanting them to be submissive and stop expressing opinions and do what the blokes want them to do.
So over the years, I've seen, you know, various critiques of shows such as this.
Yeah.
And this has been going on for decades, right? Shows yes. in this format. Do you think it's helpful to have these publicly aired and then we have a collective discussion?
Yes. About it.
Yeah. Us what does this to mean? Politicians. What does this mean?
Yeah.
How do we judge people like this?
Yeah.
And to what extent do we call them out? Is that a good thing, or does it actually amplify values that are ultimately really harmful?
I really want your take on this because, so Tanya Plibersek, a social services minister, she put a post on Instagram that went kind of nuts, slamming the show for platforming Tyson, saying, when men who idolise submissive and obedient women are normalised on primetime TV, it means coercive control is given a national platform. Obedience is not a relationship preference. It's about exerting power and control over women. And we know that this too often leads to violence. My view is it's important to have these discussions. Like, I don't like it when it simply exists in pockets of the internet. And of course, there's deeply offensive, like, you know, racist, homophobic, all kinds of horrible views that you don't want to air because you do give it credence. Like Nazism. I would not give a Nazi a platform. Mm. But when there's something that actually has got a real currency as being picked up more and more, and actually part of the reason I'd like sat up in my seat watching this is because I have seen a lot of conservative blokes trying to explain what the role of the doctrine of, for example, headship, where a man is there to be the head of the woman and the woman is to submit, trying to explain that without having it sound like power. They'll always be like, oh, it's about sacrifice. The man will sacrifice
and
himself.
And it's biblical too, right? I mean, this is...
Well, yes, yes and no. Yes, to the extent that you will find verses in there that says, yes, a woman should not have authority over man, a woman should submit to a husband, but they're preceded, for example, by verses saying you both should submit to each other out of reverence for Christ. So, but it's a question of like what you put emphasis on. So when someone on the show says, well, don't you think you're better off finding a woman like that in church? Tyson goes, yeah, actually, you're probably right. I do agree with that. But I wrote a piece about this on the weekend where I spoke to a woman called Jen Barker, who's the founder of this online independent like Christian women's platform called Fixing Her Eyes. And she was like, no, we don't, but that's not how we see women here. That's not what that you're holding on to archaic views. And actually that's not what's in the Bible when it comes to the role of women. So where do you stand though, Jez? Because I obviously have got a strong view on this because yeah. I think explain it, put it in plain language. Let's have the chat. Things get stuck in rhetoric or hidden or minimized. Like, tell me what you actually think and let's talk about it.
I agree with that.
Yes.
The only thing I am cautious about, yeah. very cautious, is yeah. the fact that it's presented as entertainment. And I have a very, very strong feeling yes. that we need to be careful about what we laugh about, what we are entertained by,
yes.
because it becomes us.
But
and so,
yes.
I often say this to, you know, sort of people in my life, just be careful about what you laugh about because the things that you laugh about are slowly eroding us from the inside without us even realizing it.
Yeah.
And that's the problem I have with it. I don't know if people really go to, you know, a show like Maths, Temptation Island when I was younger for a moral education. It's yeah. entertainment. It's something that's, you know, generally laughed yes. off. And it's that kind of reception in my head that kind of jars with me because this is really quite a serious issue and it has real life consequences when yeah. we talk about control yep. and abuse and coercion. I guess that's where maybe we slightly differ.
Yeah. I'm completely aware of the pitfalls of a reality TV show like this. Yeah. And in fact, years previously I've tuned in and gone, usually you see really abusive blokes on there who are kind of like, you know, gaslighting the women and just treating them appallingly. And you can see the insecurity and you can see them feeding off
awful
that.
People all around.
They can,
like,
yeah.
Really and just this, kind of, but, you know, either damaged, really shouldn't be exposed on a national platform like
100%.
This, do need the therapy. I've met a few reality stars who are actually really lovely.
Yeah.
So it's not a condemnation of the genre itself, but it It isn't even real.
Are set up, and I think we have to worry about that.
Yeah.
Because it has, you know, a lot of people have been suicidal after being on reality TV shows, or they're away from their family, they lose control of their emotions, they haven't slept properly for days, and they, you know, like, and you have an outburst and suddenly you're the villain from
And the showrunners create those conditions. Like, they'll keep you awake for 18 hours and then make you do a 3-hour interview. What are you going to do?
Totally.
Cry.
Yeah.
Like, all the way through it.
Yeah. There is a real dishonesty in that a lot of the time. And to have to say, though, this season has been about women being mean, like really losing it at other women and shredding them in public. There's been woman after woman. I've been like, what the hell? Anyway, another discussion for another time, Jez. But the only – I agree with you on not making entertainment out of like misogyny. For example, and you know, Tyson, at the point at which he, by the way, has stormed off the show was when he was challenged on his views on gay people as well, which he was kind of like, it's fine, just don't put it, shove it in my face, blah, blah. So going back to that point that I said earlier about what some of the pleasure in it is, it's not to go, oh, he says women should be dogs.
Lol, yeah.
No, it's more like, holy mate, are you right? And then you know that there'll be a point where he sat down on the couch and someone's going to say, there'll be a woman there who's saying, what do you mean? What are you saying about women? And there's something satisfying in that. And does that sound mean to you? Because say someone was on there and just, I don't know, putting down, yeah, I don't know. I guess it is a fine line now. I hear myself say it out loud.
No, you've convinced me. Like, I can see the value in the entertainment. Like, I understand. And I know tons of people who love shows like this.
Yeah.
And no judgment on them. Yeah. It's not for me.
Yeah.
But I'm fascinated and interested in what it is that people get out of it.
Oh, it's distraction when the world is going crazy. You know, I wouldn't even say I'm an ardent fan or anything. I just kind of got into it. And sometimes you are a bit sickened by it, and sometimes it is awful, but it's weird when you see people being corrected for being mean or narcissistic. Or mind you, the problem is they then go on to do it the following week. So, but I think it's a really fascinating question about we are seeing these views about women more broadly, more openly, more loudly expressed, and how do we respond to it? Do we just shout people down? Do you just laugh at them? Not everyone's going to be popped on a couch. Do you know what I mean? And I don't think this is going to be the last time we're going to be having this kind of discussion.
Okay, time for pick of the week. Jules, one of my favourite parts of my week.
Me too. What have
you got for me?
Okay, Jez, do you know who Elisa Healy is?
Oh, champion. Yeah.
Wow. I don't think she's as known and as fated, as celebrated as she should be, because she has just retired from women's cricket, right?
She's absolutely incredible.
She is a legend. Yeah. So, batter, captain, wicketkeeper, has just retired. 299 match international career with more than 7,000 runs, almost 300 dismissals. She is the one that led the women to that Ashes victory last year that was 16-0. Highest individual score. I mean, she's actually been a real phenomenon. And I tell you, I was looking at the coverage of her last match, and you know that all the cameras were trying to find her so they could hone in on her. They offered her, do you want to open bat for your last match? No. They couldn't find her because she was in the dressing room. And she said she was like, she didn't want to take off her, like if she took off all her gear, then that's probably everyone would get out. The way cricket works, you'll probably then be called out. And she just sat alone in the dressing room. She said, I was just hanging around, hoping not to bat. And when there was one run to get, I was able to take everything off and just enjoy that moment. It was nice to not have it be about me. And I think there's a real combination of humility and talent in her that should be celebrated. And I do think that there's a lot of focus on the Matildas, who I love, who are great. When you look at the accomplishments of the Australian women's crickets team, arguably, if not they, one of the greatest or most successful sporting teams this country has ever produced, I would just like to tip my hat to someone who captains and in the very last moment says, I just don't want this all to be about me.
She is a very impressive woman.
Yeah. Jez, what about you?
Okay, Jules, have you heard this furor around one Timothy Chalamet?
I have. I'm quite across this.
Like, you would have to live under a rock not to have heard about it. But basically, he's gone on and made some comments about opera and ballet being dying art forms, and the reaction to it has been quite.
Tell us about the context.
He was in an interview with. I actually want to talk about this with you another time. Like, we've totally run out of time today, so let's do it for our next episode.
Yes.
But I just want to draw attention to the fact that he's kind of really done this massive takedown of ballet and opera. And the reaction to it has been swift and brutal and hilarious. And I think it's worth exploring because I think this is a controversial thing to say, but I think there might be a seed of truth to what he's said.
Controversial.
So let's talk about it. Yeah. But I got in touch with my good friend Megan Burslem at ABC Breakfast. Yeah. And we were talking about this and talking about the great moments in opera arias, in ballet. And so for my pick of the week, I've made you and our listeners a playlist of a top 10 that Megan and I put together. So Megan and I, some of our listeners may know, we host a few live
music
events during the year. So I've made a top 10 of Jez and Megan's top opera and ballet moments. And I've begun with an Australian commission. This was commissioned by Opera Australia, who brought in Kate Miller-Heidke back in 2014 to write a story, an operatic performance. It's an allegory about colonization. So I've put on the playlist, we start with a piece called Where, and it's an adaptation of a story called The Rabbits. I've also put in there this terrific moment in the 1998 Grammy Awards when Pavarotti basically called in sick. He was meant to perform Nessun Dorma. Mm. So at the last minute, Aretha Franklin steps in, sings Nessun Dorma. Now, you know the voice and that genre.
I have actually heard that.
And you kind of go, this is
incredible.
Superb and completely unexpected.
Yeah.
I've put in there Romeo and Juliet by Prokofiev. And I've ended with an opera from Turandot performed by Dame Joan Sutherland. It is literally the sound, like, just imagine if you die and if you've been a good person, you go to heaven, and as the pearly gates are opening, this aria is the sound of you going to heaven.
As opposed to bum,
kid
bum.
You, exactly.
This is the sound you want.
But what I want to say is that there are some great opera and ballet moments in broader arts industry that is genuinely struggling.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this.
Okay, Jez, that sounds fantastic.
If you have a moment, I'll put the link in the show notes to this playlist. Have a listen.
Give us your feedback.
Let's talk about it and maybe forward it on to Timothy Chalamet as well.
I love it. Good to see you, Jez.
Our producers are Madeline Jenner at Cinema Nippard. Jules, see you next time.
Squ-